Welcome back to The Pleasure Project with Dr. Jen Kennedy. In this episode, I interview Dr. Peggy Klein-Platz. She is a celebrated author and researcher, and I just love her work. I had read her book, Magnificent Sex, when it came out last year, and I was just so appreciative because it really, really touched on a lot of important things for folks in longer-term relationships who still want to know how to keep some magic and how to help the sexual part of their relationship maintain. So that's what she and I talk about. Tune in. I'd love to hear your feedback. Okay, so welcome back to The Pleasure Project with Dr. Jen Kennedy. My guest today is Peggy J. Klein-Platz. She's a PhD. She's a professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa. She's a certified sex therapist and educator. Her research focuses on optimizing sexual experience with a particular interest in sexual health in older people, the disabled, chronically ill, and other marginalized populations. Dr. Klein-Platz has edited or authored 5 books, including New Directions in Sex Therapy, Innovations and Alternatives, which is the winner of the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, also known as ASECT, their 2013 Book Award, along with A. Dana Menard, PhD. She wrote Magnificent Sex, Lessons from Extraordinary Lovers, which is the winner of the 2021 Society for Sex Therapy and Research Consumer Book Award. And that is what we're going to be talking about today. Also, in 2015, Dr. Klein-Platz received the ASECT Professional Standard of Excellence Award, and in 2021, she received the Distinguished Sexual and Gender Health Revolutionary Award by the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health of the Medical School, University of Minnesota. In 2022, she became a fellow of the American Psychological Association. So, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. You know, your book has been a game changer for my therapy practice. I have a lot of couples that have been together 20, 30 years, and they are between like 50 and 75 years old. And this was a big gap in the resources. So I so appreciate you writing this book.
Wow, I'm honored. Thank you so much for telling me that. I appreciate the feedback.
Yeah. Absolutely. So well, let's jump in. Tell me a little bit about what drew you to this work as a whole in the first place.
Sure. Well, probably like you, in my clinical practice as a sex therapist, the most common problem that I encounter is what's deemed for one to be low sexual desire, or for the other, too much sexual desire, what's sometimes called sex addiction, but what I think of in couples terms as sexual desire discrepancy. One wants more sex than the other. And for many years, I had a waiting list of approximately 8 months, and I was seeing the same kind of problem day in, day out. Now, as you well know, in most of the sex therapy literature, they're trying to fix the person that they see as having the problem.
Yeah, the low desire partner gets highlighted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you think in terms of what can we do for the couple, what can we help them create in the way of a sex life such that their sex becomes more desirable, then it seemed to me that it was important to study people whose sex lives were fulfilling. And in fact, people whose sex lives grew more fulfilling over time as compared to the common stereotype that says, yeah, well, great sex is something that happens, you know, in the first flush of a new relationship, and after that, it's all downhill. Mm-hmm. My team wanted to study if that was true, and what could we learn from those whose sex lives got better and richer and more fulfilling over time?
Yeah, so you were seeing things clinically, and you decided to test them out and try to understand what is happening for these folks, that where it is working, right? It's more solution rather than problem focused.
Yes. I mean, isn't that what's really fascinating and compelling to most of us? What is it that makes some sex lives more and more exciting over time?
Yeah, and I think anecdotally, we all know couples where that's happening, but we also know lots of couples where that's not happening. So I think it's a, you know, it's a universal topic, really.
Definitely.
So give some of the readers haven't read your book yet. I'm sure they will after hearing this. Give us a sense of your methodology. You know, who were your participants? What were the parameters of your study?
Well, we wanted to find couples who could have what to teach us. So we weren't interested in the main people who are the subjects in most psychological research, who are, you know, the 18-year-olds who are taking intro psych at some university. We figured we wouldn't learn that much about what makes sexual fulfillment possible, let alone enduring. So we thought, who would have what to teach us? And we thought, let's talk to old married people who self-identify as having a really fulfilling sex life. So we set out to recruit people who were in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And we approached the American Association of Retired People, church groups, synagogue groups. We advertised on the radio, not like, no offense, Spotify, but on the radio. And within 24 hours of our first recruitment blurbs going up, we had more people than we could interview in a lifetime.
Interesting. People and we responded, thought, yeah, and said, I'm in that population.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
And we also thought, who else can we learn from whose sex lives would be outside the box, where they would have to think about going outside the box in order to create magnificent sex? And we thought, what about people who self-identify as being members of sexual minority groups? So LGBTQ, or people into consensual non-monogamy, or people who were into BDSM. So we went looking for people who identified as sexual minorities to see what they might have to teach us. And it turned out we learned a lot.
Right. I love that. I think it's really helpful. And those three groups are different, but all useful and all have, and as evidence to have something to teach us about their relationship to sex that I think is quite useful.
Yeah, it's interesting because people have wondered, you know, what kinds of differences did you find between the old people and the sexual minorities? Well, let's think about it for a minute. You know, old married people are in some ways the most mainstream of mainstream, but they're also the most marginalized. When we think about hot sex, we think about young, beautiful, able-bodied, heterosexual people in new relationships where everything's fresh. But what that does is it marginalizes older couples. So at the same time that these are mainstream people, they've had to reinvent themselves as sexual beings in order to make their sex lives fulfilling over time.
Right. And to not just stay together, but to actually stay together and still have fulfilling, magnificent even sex is, yeah, I think that's intriguing.
I'm so glad.
So, all right, well, let's jump into some of the findings. Let's see. So playfulness came up as one of the elements, if you want to speak to that a little bit.
Sure. We were conducting phenomenological research, which means we asked the question, you know, what made sex wonderful for you, or what are the things that contribute to wonderful, fulfilling sexual experiences in a thousand different ways, until one way of asking the question worked for the people being interviewed. And one of the ways we asked was, so if you walked into a room filled with 100 people having wonderful sex, you know, how would you recognize the ones who were having the greatest pleasure? And some people immediately jumped on that question and said, I know, those would be the people who were smiling the most, who were laughing at each other, who were alive in the moment. And what often came up in their answers was a sense of joy, delight, even playfulness that they had observed in those who were the most engaged in the moment.
Yeah. And that makes some sense when you, it tracks with really positive sexual experiences, in terms of the energy, right? The mindset when someone's in a play mode, when someone's in a, it's the receptivity, the curiosity that accompanies that mindset.
Yes. And it's both being activated and opening oneself to receptivity, as you just said, that work together. You can picture children who are alive in their skin and who are very playful. We can picture little puppies or kittens who allow themselves to be playful. It's like once we grow up, we have to put that on the side. Not so much.
Yep.
Not so much. We need to reclaim the capacity for playfulness.
Yeah. Well, and to, you know, thinking about media in particular and how much focus there is on, you know, these top 10 lists of how to please your lover and how to create the perfect sex. And so much of it is really physical. And that is not what your findings really pointed to.
Well, it depends what you mean by physical. I mean, a lot of those top 10 lists are about tips and tricks and techniques and toys. And what we found out was that all of that was irrelevant. Oh, and I forgot positions. They also say, you know, try this position or that. That's all irrelevant. The kinds of stuff that made sex really worth wanting was about people being present within, at the same time that they were fully engaged with their lovers. Now, that sounds simple, but not so much. I mean, a lot of people think about the level of being present that they attain in a meditation class or yoga class. And that's a good start. But this is a very high level of being present. I mean, various people mentioned you could drop a bomb and they wouldn't notice it in the sexual world.
Yeah, it's like that flow state that sometimes also gets discussed in psychology. More of that.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so many people mentioned to us the book, The Inner Game of Tennis, or The Inner Game of Golf, which I'd never read. So I went out and read it. And yeah, that's exactly right. It's a flow state. But at the same time, if you're in a yoga class, you're only connecting to what's going on within you. If you're engaging in sex with another person, okay, then it's not only about being present, it's about being in sync with another human being while connected with him. And that's so far away from the world of tips and tricks and, you know, novel positions and toys. It's about being authentic while you're engaged with another person and being in sync,
right?
Within,
because
it's
interesting. It's because there's that tendency to, for some, I feel like especially young lovers, to be very performative, right? There's this, I want to look good or appear like I'm having a good time, but to actually be in your body, be registered with yourself, but then also connecting with partner. requires a whole different skill set. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mindset, I mean, really.
Yes, this is about mindset. This is the opposite of a performative mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I love this quote that was in there, which is, great lovers are made, not born.
Oh, thank you. That's me you're quoting.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, it gives hope to people, right? That it's like not either a yes or a no. It's a, well, this is possible, but it's a shift, and it's an intentionality towards, you know, moving towards that.
Yes. I mean, we asked all of our participants at what point they began to experience sex of this caliber. Mm-hmm. And we literally said, you know, did you get lucky? Were you just born this way? And they all cracked up. And they said, no. There was a shift in my mindset. You know, I thought great sex meant getting laid when I was 19. Mm-hmm. When I was in my 20s, I thought that getting laid without my parents walking in was really great. When I was in my 30s, I thought getting laid without my kids walking in was really great. When I was in my 40s, I started to wonder.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to be able to shift into the caliber of sex that we would call magnificent now until I started to be really honest with myself about what I wanted and honest with my partner. And that took a while. That mm-hmm. took 10, 15 years to really come into my own as a human being and to make my way with my partner towards these kinds of experiences. So people
well, and you said something a minute ago too. You didn't just say like having sex, you said having sex worth wanting, like right? It's there's a wanting in there, that because some people don't want sex, but maybe that's because the sex they're having isn't worth wanting.
Yeah, there's a lot of really bad sex out there. And
yes.
You know, we don't really want to talk about that, but it's true. And I'm sure in your practice, as in mine, sometimes I've been listening to couples describe their sex lives and I'm taking a sexual history mm-hmm. and thinking, yeah, if I had your sex life, I wouldn't want it either.
Right.
And the first time I said that out loud, it's like, oh no, this is a really dumb thing to say out loud. What a clinical mistake I've just made. And when I said it, the couple I said it to just looked so relieved.
Right. Well, because it gives you somewhere to go. It's not just that you don't like sex. You don't like the sex you're having.
Yeah. I mean, I've come to believe that sometimes low sexual desire is evidence of good judgment.
Right.
Maybe you don't want this, but mm-hmm. maybe that will point you towards what you do want. Mm-hmm.
So, and then in terms of kind of turning toward the idea of what participants reflected back in the way of preparation, like what do they have agency over? Like, how can they help their sex lives be better, be worth wanting?
Well, we found that there were three kinds of preparation that really made a difference. One was clearing a space. A lot of our participants mentioned having a space to be sexual, which was clean and neat. You know, I'm not talking about Martha Stewart beautiful. I'm mm-hmm. just talking about a space that felt welcoming and inviting. And they often mentioned picking up their laundry. Nobody mentioned doing laundry, just picking it up so that there was a space that felt clear. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, it's helpful to clear one's own body. Nothing dramatic, but simple stuff that makes you feel like I'm ready to be touched. Having a shower, brushing your teeth, doing whatever is needed to make you feel you're in the right space for touching and being touched. And there's a space that belongs to the two of you, perhaps your bedroom. I don't care if it's a living room couch. I don't care if it's the middle of a living room rug, but a space that the two of you have created that feels sacred just for the two of you. And last but not least, you need a kind of emotional preparation. I mean, in the movies, we see people having makeup sex, and you and I know that in real life, that's a disaster. So yeah. If there is any lingering conflict between the individuals, they're not going to feel like a couple until they deal with any residual anger that's hanging over from their last fight.
Yeah.
Or the fight that hasn't been
had yet.
Allowed.
Yeah. Yeah. Because otherwise then it goes back to more performative or, you know, or working a, like, you know, maybe getting off, but not the magnificent sex that really we're talking about here. It's because it's not the connecting sex when there's the static of the tension.
Yeah, you're going through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're going to avoid sex entirely. I mean, who wants to be really intimate with someone with whom there's hostility?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that might be very long-standing, too. It might not be a recent conflict. It might be a resentment that you've been carrying for years.
Well, that's going to make sure that there isn't much sexual frequency in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Also, when you mentioned the first thing that you said was a clean, neat, inviting space, I can't even believe how many couples, when we're talking about, you know, looking back at positive sexual experiences, cite hotels, hotel rooms. And I think because there's no, your laundry's not at the hotel. Everything's tidy and perfect. And, you know, it's lacking distraction in the same way that your home bedroom might be.
That's such a good point. I mean, people talked about the intention that they brought to the experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And without the right kind of intention, it just isn't going to happen. And sometimes you need something just as clear as picking up laundry. It's not something massively difficult. You don't have to actually, as our participants pointed out, do the laundry, just put it in the hamper.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, to some degree, because you can choose to be distracted by anything. So it's a negotiation with yourself to do what you can, but then also let go and choose to be present.
Yeah.
So I love that your participants, many of them anyway, were older. And one of the things that I remember hearing in the book was sex becomes more human with age. And I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, as I was saying earlier, one's conception of what made sex great became more demanding over time. People's standards went higher and higher. So if the sex of a couple of teenagers is relatively performative and the desire is only to get off, mm-hmm. over time, people want sex that becomes more intimate, which means some combination of sex that requires greater trust because there will be more emotional risk-taking, more erotic risk-taking. And that makes the nature, the quality of the sex that people will be having more kaleidoscopic, more multidimensional, yes, more human, and everything that that word implies.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also this element of age that came up in here about people's own relationship to their aging body, to their ability, to their their non-attachment, I guess, to things that might have felt very important, usually appearance, sometimes ability, at a younger age. And, you know, their headspace is different, which allows for more connectivity or joy in general.
Yes. I mean, some people really stand out in my memory from the interviews. For example, one gentleman who said, with the right partner, I don't need Viagra. With the wrong partner, Viagra isn't going to help. Or a woman who had said that she had never felt more beautiful in her life. And she was a woman who was in her 70s who'd had a mastectomy. And she remembered that when she was a young, very beautiful woman, she always felt like people were staring at her body rather than grasping the person within. And she had now become so embodied in her own experience that how other people saw her became less relevant. She was at home in her body. And how other people saw her just didn't matter as much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that in the book that the relational maturity that can come, that the folks that are older sometimes are more successful at tolerating discomfort and not physical, but sometimes physical, but you know, they're able to regulate or they're able to have perspective on self that's really valuable.
Well, you've got to be able to be really authentic if you're also going to be willing to take emotional risks. So this is not about playing it safe. It is about having enough trust within yourself and within the relationship so that you can afford, as many of our participants said, to jump off cliffs while holding hands together.
Yeah. So how does that pair now, sort of looking at one of the other groups rather than the older folks, but the folks that maybe are polyamorous, where they don't have the long-term relationship with that person. They have a long-term relationship with themselves, maybe, but they don't have the same benefit of familiarity.
Well, I'm not sure that that holds for our participants. I mean, many of the poly participants that we interviewed had been in long-term relationships of 20, 30, 40 years.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I mean, we did come across people who'd had one-night stands. We also came across people who contacted us after the initial recruitment who said, I'm wondering if it would be okay for you to interview me. I had been married for over 50 years, but my partner has now died. Would it be okay to be interviewed about my long-term relationship, which I remember fondly, or my new relationships? And that was really interesting. I mean, we were sort of discovering, yes, there is life after death. Even after a beloved partner dies, it was possible for them to, if you will it, transfer their ways of being that they had acquired the capacity for in the context of their long-term relationship and take those new ways of being into new relationships, which was pretty mind-blowing, I thought.
That's great. Well, and it's interesting because I'm sure many listeners can relate to having positive sexual experiences and then really neutral slash negative. And then, you know, kind of going, was it me? Was it us? Was it them? Was it, and it might be a combination of any of the above. But it's not like you can, your skills don't port, right? You can't do what you do with everybody and have it work out great because everyone's different and you're different.
And each individual's wishes are unique, and what you'll want will vary from partner to partner and from time to time.
Right.
Let me put it the opposite way for contrast. Is that okay?
Sure.
Very often when I'm working with heterosexual couples who are in performative mode, the husband will often say, you know, I figured out the formula one day of exactly how to stimulate her so as to bring her to orgasm as quickly as possible. you know, first you do A, then you do B, then you, you know, stimulate T three times, and then, and I did it the next day and it worked, and I did the same thing the next day and it worked, and I did the same thing over and over, and it stopped working. What went wrong? Well, what went wrong was that you were looking for a formula, and there's nothing that kills desire more quickly than doing what works relentlessly.
Right. Yeah.
What you've communicated is that you were more interested in the formula than the person within. And so it's not about searching for novel solutions. It's about searching for the person within who changes over time and is allowed to change over time.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't it get boring if we were all that predictable and we just stayed the same way all of our lives?
Mm-hmm.
How much more interesting to have sex when you are renewed?
Well, and that the partner, like, that's also in that scenario, the assumption is we're trying to get to orgasm. I can't believe it took us this long in the conversation to say the word orgasm, by the way. But the goal is orgasm and as quickly as possible versus this is an exploration. This is a meandering experience together. Very different
and
frame.
This is how grown-ups get to play. Let me play you. Let me play with you. Let me explore with you.
Mm-hmm.
Not with the goal necessarily of finding something new, but finding who you are that's new today. Who am I that's different than I was yesterday?
Yeah, and if the goal is to get to orgasm, or if the goal for one partner is that and the other partner is to get it over as quickly as possible, there's no room for magnificent sex in that formula.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about the importance of empathy.
Yes. So we did a series of studies, as you know, from reading the book. And our first one, we were looking for what are the characteristics, what are the qualities that make sex magnificent? And one of them was empathic communication, which I'll talk about more in just a second. But interestingly, in the next set of studies that we did, where we looked at people who were having really wondrous sexual experiences, and we asked them what led to it, empathic communication came up again. So it's not only a component of optimal sexual experiences, it's a contributing factor. It's something that actually brings it about. So this is a core feature of magnificent sex on every level. And it's not only about verbal communication, though I have to say that interviewing these people was one of the great delights of my life, and that of my graduate student, or then graduate student, Dana Menard, now Dr. Menard, a professor at the University of Windsor now. But these people were also able to touch in ways that expressed their capacity for empathy. So it's not only that they were great communicators verbally, but they allowed themselves to communicate empathically in the way they touched other people and the ways they allowed themselves to receive touch. So again, let's think about the opposite for purposes of comparison. You and I have both had clients who say, you know, when my partner touches me, it's like she's just going back and forth and back and forth, back and forth, like she's polishing wood.
Yes.
She doesn't seem to notice the subtleties of what I'm asking for, what my body is asking for in a given moment.
Yeah.
Also, think about the ways that we react rather than respond fully when we're being touched in ways that we don't want.
Right.
So our bodies shut down, our bodies withdraw, our bodies tense, literally when we don't feel at ease about being touched. But if you are able to receive empathically, then your body just opens spontaneously to the various ways that your partner is touching you. So
and
two
so
people
much
who are
of this is nonverbal, right? It's the how, it's the eye contact, it's the quality of touch in terms of course speed, but pressure and so many things. And I mean, so much of communication in general with couples is nonverbal. So of course it's going to factor in here.
Yes, but this is bigger than the usual elements that we teach couples to watch for in nonverbal communication. This is noticing the temperature of your partner's skin. This is noticing when their bodies open up and let go and invite you to touch them more deeply. When we invite each other to penetrate metaphorically rather than just literally, so that we can really under another person's skin.
In this realm, I guess I've had for couples, especially who haven't had touch in a very long time and haven't had any type of sexual interaction, is I've had them work with Sensate. And some couples really love it. Like they just, it's a path back in. They really appreciate it. Other couples can't do it. They find it too mechanical and awkward. How do you feel about it?
Well, as you know from the final part of the book, Magnificent Sex, after 12 years of doing research, starting in 2013, our team decided to find out about whether we could apply the lessons we learned from the extraordinary lovers to couples who are having sexual desire discrepancy problems. And we developed a group therapy approach to treat couples with sexual desire discrepancies in which we do not do Sensate focus. There are a lot of exercises, but none of them are mechanical, and we never tell couples what to touch or where or how. We never prescribe genital contact, for example. So, yes, clearly we do feel that touch is an important element of the empathic communication that makes the best sex wondrous. But even that has to come from within rather than prescribed exercises.
Yeah, so of course it's highly relational, and it's also your relationship to self that's going to be so critical in this pursuit.
Yes, you need the two intertwining.
So I was kind of chuckling as it came up periodically throughout the book that sex therapists were also one of the populations you spoke to in this, and their answers were usually a departure from the participants that were in the other populations. And so, you know, I wonder why that is, and if, you know, if you have I don't know, ideas about probably things perpetuating, things that have been in the literature incorrectly probably get reused. But yes, I'd love for you to sort of address that.
Yes, so the sex therapists were focused in their answers on sexual function and dysfunction, which of course is what we're trained to work with. We're trained to take couples who have sexual dysfunction and help them function normally. But I don't think I've ever met anybody who wanted to function normally, per se, as the end goal. I mean, yes, we deal with couples with premature ejaculation and difficulties with orgasm or pain on intercourse. And of course, they want to have normal functioning. But what we found in our research is that functional sex is not sufficient to bring about optimal sexual experiences. And that correspondingly, you don't need sexual function in order to bring them about. So we saw plenty of people with some of the sexual problems that come with age. So they had chronic illnesses, they had disabilities, mm-hmm. and that never got in their way,
right.
which we found really illuminating and is the opposite of what we're trained to do as sex therapists.
Right.
What we're trained, sex therapists, is just bring people back to the norm.
Yeah.
No, for Magnificent Lovers, there was something on a completely different dimension than function or dysfunction.
Right. And it was working with what they did have and what they did enjoy. And it was more of a mindset than, right, than just hot sex in terms of physical appearance or, you know, oftentimes what's, you know, what's put out there.
Well, it depends on what you mean by working with what they do have. I mean, none of them were settling, that's for sure. Quite the opposite. They were aiming higher than they had when they were still conventionally.
I mean, I guess I was thinking like some people had chronic pain or those types of things like in their body, but they didn't even name that, you know, as a barrier. They sort of just, you know, they were happy to just participate and highlight how much enjoyment they're getting out of their sex. They didn't even name the disability, right? You guys sometimes noted it because, you know, they were physically in front of your researcher perhaps, but that's interesting, is that they weren't throwing, you know, that up as a barrier. They didn't register it as such for this purpose, which is different than what maybe we think they would have done.
Well, they redefined sexuality so that it wasn't about sexual function or dysfunction, being mm-hmm. conventionally able-bodied or being disabled. Sexuality right. was about something much deeper and higher and richer than put tab A into slot B.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. So, well, we're just about done here. Is there anything that's like a key element that you feel like I missed that you want to make sure our listeners hear?
You're a fantastic interviewer, and I'm just so honored to have had this opportunity to chat with you. No, there's absolutely nothing that you left out that was crucial for our work. I'm really grateful. And if anybody is interested, you know, we are now training people all over North America and all over the world in how to run groups for couples who have sexual desire discrepancy or couples who have chronic illness and disability and want more out of their sex lives. So please get in touch.
And is that at the optimalsexualexperiences.com? Is that the best place to find you?
Yes, please. Thank you.
All right. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.